and welcome to another episode of the Stumbled Upon podcast. I am your host, Kate. Happy Friday, everybody. I hope that you had a great week and that you are looking forward to the weekend. I realized while I was editing the podcast for last week that in my intro, I failed to explain what this podcast was about. So sometimes I just kind of assume that people know what's going on in my brain, and that is not the right way to go about this. So this podcast, for those of you that are new here, welcome, first of all. And secondly, this podcast is about random deep dives that have been inspired by real life events. So whether that's something that actually happened to me or something that came up in conversation or something that I just happened to notice at one point and it sent me into a research kind of spiral. So that is where my topics come from for this podcast. And this week, we are talking about memories and how they work. And I think this is really interesting because so much of what our brains do and are capable of, we seriously still do not understand a lot of that. We don't understand how it works, truthfully, like real in the nitty gritty. And it's just really interesting to me, if you think about it, that our brains are what we use to understand how things work around us. And our brain doesn't understand how our brain operates. And it just gets real trippy if you think about it like that. At least it does for me. And so I thought that this would be an interesting topic because what sparked it really, truthfully, at the beginning is that my best friend and I were talking. We've been friends for 20 years now, and we have memories of events where I will have like crystal clear memories of something that has occurred in our past, and she will have no recollection of it, or vice versa. And so that got me thinking about how our memories actually work and how our brain actually processes memories and that kind of thing. So I sort of started to go down this deep dive. And then in addition to that, you know, I feel like it's a pretty common fear for people that, you know, you see people who maybe in your own life or in the lives of those people that you know, the folks that get older and then start to go through dementia, or maybe not even just that severe memory loss, but just memory loss in general. And that's kind of something that scares me a little bit, if I'm being honest. And I wondered if maybe there was something that I could do now while I am fairly young to avoid maybe some of those things later in life. Because like losing your memory sucks, right? And so I just wondered if there was something that we could do now to sort of help prevent that. And again, it's not 100% understood, but at least there are some tips that we can implement to hopefully help in the long run. So let's start with the facts. Kareem Nader is a neuroscientist at McGill University in Montreal, and he has some new research that suggests the act of remembering can alter our memories. It may be impossible for humans or any other animal to bring a memory to mind without altering it in some way. Now, not all researchers agree with this, and so it's still very much in the early stages of research and understanding and that kind of thing. But if he is right, this potentially could be used to help people who have PTSD, and we'll kind of get into that in just a little bit. He argues that flashbulb memories, which are, I think, like major events, so for those of you that are old enough, something like 9/11, for example, are more susceptible to change because we replay them in our minds over and over again, whether that just be through, you know, your own recall when you're thinking about things or when you're talking about the event with other people, friends, family, that kind of thing. In the research, they have found that recording a memory requires adjusting the connections between your neurons. So we're going to get a little bit sciencey, nerdy right now. Eric Condal is a neuroscientist at Columbia University in New York City, and he has 5 decades of research into memory and how it works under his belt. So he's a pretty well-respected expert. And he won a share of the 2000 Nobel Prize in psychology or medicine. So he's legit, right? He found that short-term memories involve simple chemical changes to the synapse, which is the gap between your neurons. So if you can think of what a neuron looks like, the cell, those are the cells in your brain, right? And they have little gaps in between them, right? Which is where they send their chemical signals. So for example, neuron A will send a chemical out to neuron B, which is the message that it's trying to convey. And that chemical signal is received by receptors on neuron B, and then that message is then carried forth to wherever it needs to go, right? And so short-term memories involve just a simple chemical change in that synapse. Long-term memories, on the other hand, are actually built into the synapse with proteins. Okay, so it's not just a little chemical exchange, it is an actual structure that gets built into the synapse when you are making long-term memories. And the general assumption around this has been that these protein changes or structural changes are stable and sort of permanent. And so they call this consolidation. So your long-term memories are consolidated when they are built into your neurons. So Nader believes that his experiments show that recalling memories creates a sort of reconsolidation, which opens the memory itself up to distortions. Currently, science cannot confirm for sure that that's what is happening yet, but his experiments are really interesting. So he uses mice, and scientists use mice because they are really easy to train. So for cognitive experiments, it's really easy to get them to understand patterns, right? For his experiments, what he would do is he would make this noise, and then immediately after the noise was made, he would shock the mice. He did it enough that they would react as if they were gonna get shocked when it was just the noise that was made. It was a long enough time period to where it was considered a long-term memory, not just a short-term memory, right? So they've learned that I hear this noise and I'm gonna get shocked, and so they act accordingly. So then what he would do is, once that step was complete, he would make the noise, but he injects them with a drug that disrupts the creation of the proteins in the neurons, right? He injects this drug, makes the noise, nothing happens. And that happens enough to where now the mice act when they hear the noise after that. They just go about their business. So it's like they never learned that the noise equals shock. So that is where he's sort of coming with this idea that when you are recalling the memory, so the mice are remembering that that noise meant a shock was coming, but because they couldn't form new long-term memories, or they couldn't consolidate that memory again, then the next time they hear the noise, it's like they're hearing it for the first time and there's no consequence. That makes sense. That is sort of where his experiments have kind of led to this line of thinking about how our own memories work, or our own recollection of memories work. So another psychologist, Elaine Brunet at the Douglas Mental Health University Institute in Montreal, is using this information to help patients with PTSD. So he gives these patients, and of course, obviously everybody has signed up for these experiments, right? So it's not like the 70s when they would just do experiments on people without informed consent. That's actually an interesting deep dive. We might go on one of those. That's really interesting. The psychological studies that were done back in the day when they were not telling patients what they were doing, or they were being a little bit vague when they were telling them what they were doing. And then there were lots of interesting / horrible results of these experiments. We might do a deep dive on that. That would be interesting, I think. Okay, so anyway, back to this guy. He gives patients with PTSD a drug that inhibits memory and then has them read a script of their trauma, like while they have the drug in their system. In a 70-patient trial, within 6 weeks, they showed a 50% reduction in PTSD symptoms. So the treatment is not erasing the memory, so by having them recalling these memories over and over again, but having that drug that kind of messes with the way that we store the memory, it's not erasing the memories, but what it is doing is helping to weaken their emotional tone. So it reduces the severity of those memories, which could help people with PTSD PTSD and other trauma-related mental conditions to maybe regain some sense of normalcy, or regain their confidence in, you know, being able to sort of live with this trauma but not be crippled by the trauma, if that makes sense. So Nader is now questioning whether all memories become vulnerable when they are recalled, or just certain ones under certain circumstances. So there's still a lot of nuance that goes with this, and there's still quite a bit that obviously we don't understand. And so he's wanting to sort of like dive deeper and sort of really get to the nitty-gritty of this. He suggests that reconsolidation may be the brain's mechanism for recasting old memories in the light of everything that's happened since, to keep us from living in the past. And so I think this is really interesting because, you know, when you're talking about biological mechanisms, a lot of times, you know, scientists come to it from the perspective of like, well, how does this help us in the evolutionary scheme of things? Like, why did this particular trait or this particular mechanism or this particular thing develop in humanity? Like, what purpose does it serve? Do you know what I mean? So, for example, you know, the fight or flight response makes a lot of sense evolutionarily, right? Because you run into a bear or you bump into a bear and like, yeah, you need to get out of there, right? So that survival instinct makes sense from a biological perspective. Looking at this memory reconsolidation thing, you know, the traits that we have don't just develop out of thin air. You know, it's something that helped us in some way at some time. So if you think about this, like, what is the purpose of this mechanism and why would it be helpful? And I think it makes sense to me anyway that reliving a memory but having your brain reform that memory in itself with the knowledge of hindsight could be helpful in a way, because it helps you maybe learn more from that memory or learn more from that experience, or even just view that experience from the perspective of, well, I'm on the other side of it now, so I can understand maybe a little bit more or something, rather than just recalling it as it happened in the moment, maybe. I don't know. I'm just spitballing here. I don't really know. Clearly no one else does either, so we're all just trying to figure out what's going on in the world, or in our brains, or both, all of the above. We're just here trying to learn a little something about something, you know? So I also read another study about how memory works, and they were talking about how dopamine specifically plays a significant role in our ability to recall and store past events. So dopamine, for those of you that are unfamiliar, is a neurotransmitter. It's a chemical in our brain, and it does a lot of things. And I don't think that we even, at this point, kind of understand how far reaching it is, how much dopamine or how large of a part dopamine plays in the way that our brain works and the way that we understand things and do things and all of that. So anyway, dopamine is important. Okay, that's what I'm trying to get at. And it plays a significant role in our ability to recall and store past events, which is called episodic memory. They found that genes that influence the density of dopamine receptors and the amount of dopamine available for the transmission of a signal are different in people. Some people have like a lot of these genes. Some people do not have so many of these genes. And it's really, some like have a mix of a lot of the receptors, but like less of the amount of dopamine and vice versa and all that. So it's like on a continuum. It's not like yes or no. So they did a study of older adults aged 59 to 71 with more of these genes, and they found that they had better memory recall after a week, and that younger adults ages 20 to 31 had no effect. So it appears as though, also just as a side note, like what about people who are in the age bracket of 32 to 58? Like they were just completely left out. So I don't really know what that means. I think the point of this study was more so to take the two sort of bookends of adult age and think about, or see how these genes affected people's ability to memory recall, to recall episodic memories, right? And so the older folks who had more of these genes, so they had denser dopamine receptors and a greater amount of dopamine available to them, had a better memory recall than those who had fewer of those things. And then for younger people, it didn't seem to really have an effect. And actually, now that I'm talking about this, I wonder if they tried to see if the dopamine from like a mental health perspective was a factor either, or if that's a different gene or genes. So like, for example, people who have chemical imbalances, right? They're talking about things like serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine. So those are sort of the three big, oxytocin too. I forgot about her. So anyway, there's like several neurotransmitters that are responsible for like mood and that are responsible for how anxious we are or how depressed we are or, you know, not or whatever. So anyway, these neurotransmitters, like people who have anxiety, depression, that kind of thing, can have chemical imbalances that are creating those sort of mental health issues. And so that's why medications like SSRIs help these people, right? Because they're helping to regulate that imbalance. And so I wonder if in this study, they looked at that as being a factor as well. Because I would wonder if, let's say you have fewer genes that regulate the amount of dopamine available. So does that mean that it affects your memory recall in old age as well as your mental health in young age? Or are those two completely different things? Are they unrelated? I would think that they're not unrelated because, again, like your brain is one thing, right? It's all working together. It's a whole system. So I would think that it would make sense that maybe people who have a lower amount of dopamine available to them are also more prone to mental health issues, right? So does that mean that the medications could potentially help as they age with their memories? I don't know. Maybe. I didn't look into it. Maybe you can see if that's a thing. So I just thought that was interesting that it sort of goes into the nature versus nurture side of things. So how much of our memory is affected by our genetics and our brain chemicals, and how much of our memory is affected by our environment and like things that we do and activity and that kind of thing. So I did look up ways to improve your memory. This list is from the Mayo Clinic. So take that for what it's worth. They list 7 ways to improve your memory. And the list is as follows. Number 1, be physically active. And by that, they mean 150 minutes per week of moderate aerobic exercise. So think like walking, something to get your heart rate up a little bit, but not anything too strenuous. Is sort of the minimum, I guess. And I don't know how they came up with these numbers, so bear that in mind. Number 2, stay mentally active. Number 3, spend time with others. This is because depression or stress can contribute to memory loss. Oh, so yes, your dopamine levels for sure affect mental health and memory. I'm glad that I went on that whole tangent and then forgot that. It's pretty ironic that I forgot that that was a tip. So good job, Kate. So spending time with others, the thought process behind that is that if you spend time with others, it will help reduce your stress and can help reduce symptoms of depression and therefore help with avoiding memory loss. Number 4 is stay organized. So if you know where things are, it's easier to recall where they are. Number 5, sleep well. Adults on average need 7 to 9 hours of good sleep. So it's not just 7 to 9 hours of laying in your bed. It is 7 to 9 hours of actual good restful sleep, which I know can be hard to achieve. So again, take this for what it's worth. Number 6, eat a healthy diet. They did not specify a specific diet, but I think that we can all agree that limiting our processed food intake and increasing our whole food intake is probably the better way to go. I think in our Western culture, we are already seeing the negative impact of our diets and how we've been eating and sort of relying on fast food, convenience food, that kind of thing. And that opens up a whole nother debate about access to better food and the cost of all of that. And so that is a whole big ass can of worms that I'm not opening right now, but maybe it's something we can definitely look into in the future to talk about, because it is something that's important. And I think that access to healthy food choices for everyone is important and something that we really need to do a better job about, because it is wild how great of an impact on just these things, your drive to be physically active, your mental activity level, your sleep. All of these things are affected by how you fuel yourself. And so it's important to remember that. And it's also important to remember that not everyone has access to the quote unquote best choices. So like, what are people supposed to do when they don't have access to affordable, healthy options? Do you know what I mean? Like, this is something that we probably need to talk about. And then number 7, manage chronic health problems. So this list is, as I said, pretty generic and kind of just general health advice. I didn't feel like it was really specifically tailored to memory in general, but I think it just kind of highlights the fact that your body is a whole system. Your general health is important for that whole system. Like, everything works together and it's not just a bunch of isolated parts. So if you do small things to take care of that whole system, then you can reap sort of the rewards in a lot of different ways, if that makes sense. I think it's important to remember that despite there being things out of our control when it comes to memory loss, like your genetics, you don't have control over your genetics, or your brain's wiring, you also have no control over that. You can do little things that are in your control to be helpful, but also, like, don't put so much pressure on yourself about the things that you can't control. And I know that's way easier said than done. And I know that I'm guilty of it just as much as the next person. So, you know, again, take that with a grain of salt, but don't stress out too much about it is sort of the conclusion. And again, easier said than done, but stress is a killer. And anything that you can do to sort of mitigate your stress or reduce your stress, I think is a good thing. And I think that will help your overall health, as well as your mental health, as well as your memory, and all of that. Just some things to think about, some food for thought. If there is a topic that you would be interested in hearing about, I encourage you to email me at stumbledpod@gmail.com. I would love to get more topics to go on deep dives with, and I'm always willing to learn something new and find something interesting. That's pretty much it. Thank you so much for going on this deep dive with me today. I hope that you all have a great rest of your Friday and an awesome weekend. And I will be seeing you next Friday. Bye.